Let's go ahead and officially call the meeting to order at 6:09. First, let's start with roll call of the committee members, and I'll start with J.O. Washington.
Charlotte Bell.
Kendall Pickett.
Chuck Hayes.
Diane Victor.
Michael Schnell.
Okay, then we also have with Ara.
Ara.
Pronounce it any way you want.
A-R-U-P.
Just write the check.
Yeah.
Spelling right here.
Go ahead, Larry. You want
to... So I'm Larry Wise with Ara, and I'll let James and Benny introduce yourself.
And I'm James Vick with SWA Group.
I'm Pauline Wood with SWA Group.
Good. And then we have David Stahl in the back, and Jerry.
I'm the citizen.
Jerry Victor as a citizen...
Representative.
Yes. As a
so
watching. Okay.
We do have this left-handed people down here at this end of
the table. Well, you missed one. I think Chuck
missed three of us.
Okay. One, two, three, four. Oh my goodness.
What's the statistical probability of this?
It's real low.
Google that. What is it? 4 out of 8 people. All right. So I guess I'll turn it over to Larry and just go ahead.
Okay. Well, just already kind of got through and introduced. I've met several of you in the past. Some of you not, or maybe just briefly. So, just to give a little introduction. So, I was involved in the 2004 study and led that up. So, since that time, there's been some momentous changes, namely Hurricane Ike. Which obviously has had a big effect on the community here. So since 2004, we've been pretty much in a continuous process, J.O., Nancy Edmondson, and others, of trying to get funding for this project through various sources. So and I don't know the full history of when or who led the applications, but the project was funded under the 2009 CAF Coastal Impact Assistance Program, grant program, to fund the planning and design for the shoreline restoration. So there was a competitive RFP process for a design firm, which we competed on last fall, right before Christmas, I think it was, and that project was awarded to Ara. As part of our team, we have several sub-consultants, subcontractors that involved on the design side, SWA Group. So James and SWA, they're a local firm here in Houston. I guess you're not based in Houston, although probably one of the larger landscape architect firms here in town. So their involvement is around the planning and landscape architecture side of this. So what we want to do is not just address the 20 or 30 foot strip of the shoreline only, but also address Miramar Park as a whole, such that we come up with a project design that is an integrated approach. So we're not going to have something that doesn't work well with whatever other park amenities or recreational uses are proposed in the rest of the park. So, SWA also has a lot of experience in facilitating and helping bring forward kind of a public vision of what they want in the parks, urban spaces, etc.
We do a lot of work with natural systems and coastal environments. We work on the Baytown Nature Center, for example, and we love to work with water and on kind of water edges. We do natural stuff as well as another big project we did locally is the Kemah-Moore Block. So we work with the extremes, but we're most comfortable kind of working in natural systems like this project, so we're delighted to be involved.
So, and my background coming from Ara is as a design engineer, so I'm a coastal engineer, so dealing with shore protection, dredging, waves from ships, and basically anything in that interface where land and water meet each other. So that kind of gives some introduction to what we're, who we are. So what we've been tasked with doing under this project is, A, first, trying to develop a consensus plan as to what the improvements or restoration of the shoreline will look like and Miramar Park as a whole. And once we've formed that consensus, we will work up a conceptual design. So this will be a 15% or so complete design, which we'll use to develop a permit application with the Corps of Engineers. Once we develop those permit sketches and submit it to the Corps of Engineers, then the process goes pretty slow for a while. The Corps of Engineers permitting process typically takes at least 6 months to a year. We're going to try as much as we can to get under what they call a letter of permission one, which is a little bit more of a abbreviated permitting process. So one of our objectives is to make sure we tailor the project where we can to fit in with those permissions for LOP1 process. But if that doesn't work, then we'll probably have to go for a full, what they call individual permit, which is more on the 12-month side of the time frame. That said, there's no promises with Corps of Engineer permits. I mean, sometimes they go relatively fast. In my experience, typically they don't. You're typically having to hound somebody down in Galveston. And we've got one of our other firms, Fries and Nichols, will be leading that permitting process, and they'll do a wetland delineation, and also, if deemed necessary, look if we have to do an oyster reef survey or any other biological resource surveys along the park or the waterfront, and as well as if there's archaeological resource requirements, etc. So they're in charge of coordinating all that and basically hounding the Corps for the next 12 months to try and get our permit. So all of that, our objective is to get through this initial consensus building and preliminary design process by the end of June, so that we're submitting a permit application sometime around the beginning of July and move forward from there. We're hoping for about a 9-month permitting period. Once we get closer to the end of that permitting process, to the point where the Corps has told us, you know, here's the issues that we see, we go and address those issues, etc. Once we get through some of those issues to where we're fairly confident what the final permit is going to allow us to do, then we will advance the design and go through and produce the design deliverables. So that'll be a full set of plans and specifications. Those plans and specifications will be suitable for bidding out the project. We don't have a funding source identified at this point in time. Hopefully, 6 months from now or 9 months from now, maybe that'll change, and we'll be able to roll straight into construction. But we've made the assumption that the project may have to be put on hold such that we will not have final approved for construction drawing sets, plans and specifications at the end of this project, because there could be some a tropical storm, something of that nature that changes things, and we can't issue a set of approved for construction plans until we're sure that the conditions represented on those plans represent what is, you know, the current conditions at the time of construction. So but the plan set that's produced will be a 95% complete plan set. So at the time of funding the project, we'll be able to pick those back up, make whatever modifications are needed. If a new topo survey, new bathymetry survey, something of that nature is required, we can redo that work, integrate it into the plans, and quickly be ready to move forward on construction. So that's kind of the overview of what we're trying to do for the next 10 months or so. So I guess I'll open it. If there's any questions or if any of that doesn't make sense, anyone would be happy to.
So in the core, your idea is to try to get the easiest permit first. If you can't go to a full permit, if we supposedly get to the point where the Corps does permit us out, Is there any kind of time frame on that, time limit on that?
They're typically a 5-year permit, and then you can extend those permits. Typically, they'll give you one extension beyond that. In my experience, if the project is not contentious, there have not been any significant public opposition, you really won't have any trouble extending it at least the first time. And that's one other thing I should know. Part of the whole idea and reason we want to have these public input sessions and have an advisory committee, A, we want to help filter feedback from the community such that it's very difficult when you have a public setting with 30 or 50 or 100 people, everybody giving you input, to take that and try and filter it. We may not draw the conclusions. We may not know the community well enough to understand what the conclusions are. And I think part of the 2004 study, we never came to a real definitive conclusion because we didn't have that coordination process. The other piece of it is that we also want to document to the Corps of Engineers that, we have developed this with full community input and consensus, and part of that feeds into trying to get us on the accelerated permitting path.
I have a question about that.
Yeah.
When you say full community participation, are you talking about a certain percentage of the homeowners, or?
Well, if the community has been notified and welcome to participate, that is typically seen by the Corps as sufficient. Now, when they go out for, when the permitting process moves forward, they'll go out and do a public notice, and they will typically mail notices to all the adjacent property owners. So they will definitely pick up all the property owners along Miramar. It's really up to the Corps' discretion how much larger they want to make that distribution of the public notice. But and the public notice process, it's a 30-day process. At the end of that, the Corps collects all the notices or all the comments and questions that come back, basically hand that over to the consultant or the owner on the project and say, okay, here's all the things you need to address, and you've got 30 days to address all these comments and come back to us. So
not only will there be community participation in the initial design, but there'll also be in the permitting process.
Yes, yes. The only way that we could potentially, and I'm not trying to say we're going to try and do this, but if we got what they call a nationwide permit, mm-hmm. Those are permits that are designed for smaller projects typically, and you have to meet some very specific requirements. Those do not require public notice. So on a lot of projects, we try and tailor the project to get under a nationwide permit to make that whole process a lot faster. Mm-hmm. I really don't think that we would be applicable for a nationwide permit, so we most likely would not try and go that way. Okay.
Where are the wetlands that we're looking at delineating?
Well, we will, our consultant, Friesen Nichols, will come out and they'll do a wetland delineation along the entire length of the park. So during one of the prior grant application cycles, we mm-hmm. had another wetland biologist come out mm-hmm. and just informally look around and say, what do you see here? And what he said was, well, you may have some very small pockets of what they would call low-value wetlands, basically just on the land side of the revetment, where water ponds
are. Boggy Bayou?
No. Boggy Bayou, I'm sure, is all wetlands.
Right.
yeah. But I'm talking just along the shoreline itself, or along the park itself.
But when they do that, they also have to identify waters of the U.S. as part of the wetlands of the U.S.?
They have to, and I'll be honest, I cannot claim to be an expert on the mm-hmm. regulations, and they do change, or the interpretation of them change. But the waters of the U.S., all of Galveston Bay would be
right.
waters of the U.S.
Right.
Most likely Boggy Bayou would be waters of the U.S. Mm-hmm. because it's contiguous or it's hydraulically connected.
Right.
Now, when you have these small pocket or isolated wetlands, mm-hmm. They have to establish some hydraulic connectivity, I believe is the proper terms they use, to be classified as waters in the U.S. I cannot tell you how that, I know it has to deal with, you know, the hydrology of the site, how water flows, also the soils, you know, if they can establish, and plants, yeah. And if they can establish that there's somehow a nexus between that isolated wetland and a water body that is a navigable water in the U.S., then they would be a jurisdictional wetland.
Right.
So, and once something's a jurisdictional wetland, there's also, you know, varying levels of value. And, you know, the Corps, I don't think, typically wants to say, well, this is a good wetland, that's a bad wetland. I mean, they're all wetlands in their eyes. But if something is a small, isolated pocket, they view that differently than if you have a, you know, contiguous high value habitat.
Unless you fill it without permission.
Yeah. That's a whole other story. Then. Yeah. We're definitely not going there.
Right.
Yeah. And in some of our future meetings, we will have Friesen Nichols, the biologist that's going to lead us, a guy named Dan Guy. Dan will be at some of these meetings, and he's done 20, 30 years of experience in this field, so I'm sure he can address any, you know, any questions. We will be scheduling the wetland delineation sometime over the next month to 6 weeks. So there will be Dan or other biologists will be out here probably carrying these little backpack GPS units and marking off the areas that they see as potential wetlands. And they put together a wetland delineation report. It's basically their opinion, which is submitted to the Corps. And then the Corps makes the determination as to what are, you know, wetlands and what are jurisdictional wetlands. So basically the consultant gives them, here's my opinion, and then the Corps takes it and they decide, you know, yes, we agree with that. No, we don't agree with that. We're going to send our own person out in the field. You know, that's their decision. Yeah, typically they don't send the people out in the field, especially if it's a consultant that they have experience with. You know, these consultants have a reputation, so they're typically not going to you know, bid on the forms, if you will.
Right.
Okay. Discuss a little on the erosion history. I've got a few slides. I don't want to make this the intent tonight is more to listen to you guys. I don't want to try and make a major presentation here. We're not trying to present solutions, but I do have a few slides we can discuss. So first I wanted to note the topography, and I know this is a little hard to read, but white areas are 25-foot plus foot elevations, or in some of these white dots are just missing data. This is what they call a LIDAR survey. This is where they fly the plane over and shoot the laser to get the elevations. But the key point here is essentially the shorelines as you go up towards Morgan's Point and as you come down towards Red Bluff are both higher. And Shore Acres and, you know, Miramar Park is really the low point along this part of the bay. And as I'm sure everybody realizes, the natural drainage is back away from the bayfront in general, back towards Boggy Bayou and these other bayous and drainages that all flow back to the west. Zooming in a little bit, and this is also newer LIDAR that was post-storm. From a topography standpoint, you're basically higher on both the north and south sides of the park, and lowest here where Boggy Bayou comes in. Now, as I understand, I think there's currently a culvert that connects Boggy Bayou through here to the bay.
Yeah.
I think at one point this had some natural drainage through there. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So in elevations, These are in the about 8 to 9 foot elevations along Miramar Drive on either side, and more down in the 5 and 6 foot elevations in here. In terms of erosion, this was pulled from the 2004 report. Some of the very early maps, charts, navigation charts, showed the shoreline being much further out. Now, those were also maybe not quite to the same mapping standards that we have today, so I wouldn't put a tremendous amount of faith in some of that. But you see that there is a fairly well-documented progression of erosion across the site. The revetment that's there now, I don't have the full history of it. I know David said that along the north end after Ike, when the riprap was thrown up across Miramar, older sections of the revetment were exposed that had square or twisted rebar in them and other things that looked like they probably date back, maybe to the 20s and 30s. The Corps of Engineers, I know, participated in some of the revetment along here. It's documented in 1977. They have a report called the Low-Cost Shore Protection Methodologies Report, and one of the demonstration projects was the Shore Acres waterfront. Unfortunately, I don't think that means they've taken any responsibility for maintaining it over the last 40 years, but...
Did I hear a story once about a grain silo that exploded, and that's where the big pieces of cement and rebar came from?
I haven't heard that, but...
Okay. I don't know where I heard that.
Wouldn't be totally surprised, yeah.
Could be, because they...
Good pasture grass.
And in the past, grain silos had a penchant for blowing up for the event.
Yeah. As I'm sure most of you are probably aware, subsidence in this area has been a big issue. In the area of Shore Acres, Bayport area, we're probably looking at 6 to 7 feet worth of subsidence between 1906 and primarily between about or before up to about 1975 or so. The Harris County Subsidence District or Tri-County Subsidence District monitors this, and you can see their monitoring data from about 1975 on is pretty flat. But I was actually looking at it the other day, and interestingly, a lot of the sites along Southeast Harris County in the last 5 years or so are all showing a downward trend again. Not nearly as steep as it was, in the 1960s or 70s, but...
How much is it? Because that was going to be one of my questions.
I was just looking at it last night, and it was probably in the order of 1 or 2 tenths of a foot. So, a couple inches. And I didn't dig into their reports closely to see if they offer any explanation. Their, what they call extensiometers, don't penetrate deep enough such that they're picking up oil and gas extraction. And there's always been a little bit of a question as to, is there some subsidence ongoing due to oil and gas subsidence or compaction? But I don't think that is what they're picking up, so... I don't know if it's groundwater withdrawal or the fact that we've been in a long-term drought, combination of the two, I'm not sure.
Silly question, but would dredging have any effect on? Or could it?
Probably not.
Because they're doing a big project at Bayport right now.
Yeah, probably not would be my, I couldn't see a technical reason why there would be a...
I was thinking the widening might, but...
Okay. Yeah, probably not. The subsidence occurs over, much larger scale. There are faults throughout Harris County. I don't know. Many people aren't aware of that. There are some faults that are mapped in the area. I know there's one mapped down towards Seabrook, south of Red Bluff. That might be some explanation where you would have some more localized subsidence. I don't think there's any faults mapped in the Shore Acres area. Any of the extensiometers show kind of a similar trend along several of them along the area. So I don't think it's just a localized issue. And it, you know, there may be some other explanation for it. It's mm-hmm. something that's just a trend to look at, yeah. From the 2004 report, I had put together some estimates of the water levels and the storm surges, if you will, and the resulting wave heights for different storm conditions. This was pre-Ike, so you can see for a Category 3 storm, which was essentially Ike took about the worst path it could for Shore Acres. You know, I had estimated about 10-foot storm surge. I think realistically that's probably more in the 11 to 12-foot range for Ike, which you may argue was a little bit atypical for a Category 3 storm, but we're in the right general order. But I think more importantly, the wave heights on that type of storm were probably somewhere in the 6, 7, 8-foot range. So you know, that's a pretty big wave out in the middle of Galveston Bay. And I know there's some anecdotal information I've heard of you know, people, believe it or not, there were actually some tugs and offshore crew boats that were out in Galveston Bay during the storm. And, you know, that seems to be right in the kind of range that they're reporting. Again, I'm sure you guys have lived with it and are very familiar, but FEMA's in the process of updating the flood maps, the flood insurance rate maps. So I didn't print out the effective maps here, but I did print out the proposed maps, and you can see what they call the V zone is the green hash all along here. So that's areas with a 3-foot or greater wave. So that's what FEMA considers would do major structural damage. They started adding to the maps what they call LIMWA, limit of moderate wave action, which, if I remember the definition correctly, is a 1-foot wave height. So you can see a 1-foot wave height is estimated to penetrate all the way back, you know, almost to sunrise.
One and a half.
And the base flood elevation, so the base flood elevation is the storm surge plus the height of the wave crest above that, and raised up to 15 feet, and I think along the shorefront here it's 16 feet, if I remember correctly. And that's up substantially, I'm sure everybody who lives along Miramar is probably aware. This is I didn't put the legend here, but this is a map showing the amount of water inundation over top of the land during the 100-year storm surge. And these are typically in the range of 2 to 3, 4 feet. And in the area along Boggy Bayou, it's up more to the 8 to 9 and 10 foot inundation depths across there. So that's just wanted to go through kind of some preliminary information that we've gathered up from the past studies, et cetera, as to what some of the processes are. One thing I didn't talk about in here is ship wakes. There, as if you stand out on Shell Beach, I'm sure everybody's seen, you know, you can get a pretty good 1 to 2 foot ship wake come rolling in there, and then it runs up the beach even higher than that. So that is, you know, an ongoing process. It's questionable as to whether that's changed any over the last 5 or 10 years with the widening and deepening of the ship channel. I've kind of heard, you know, conflicting various people have different opinions on it. I don't think anybody has any definitive documentation that can prove one way or another that has changed over the last several years. But it is certainly a major dynamic along the Shell Beach side of the park.
I think it has changed. We have a paper from the ship pilots
mm-hmm.
that are telling the pilots to slow down because it's causing bigger waves.
Yeah.
Definitely, since they've been widening.
Well, for sure, if the ships are, you know, set on the same bell. So if they're, you know, full ahead or sea speed or whatever the bell setting they're on, with the wider, deeper ship channels, there's less friction on them from the water trying to get around them, so they can go faster on that same setting.
Yeah, they're definitely faster. Yeah, slow down.
So that kind of is an overview of some of the processes. I want to talk a little bit about the 2004 study. The study, as I think everybody's probably got copies of it, I've actually got a hard copy here of the final report, which is probably really what we should reference rather than the presentation, although I think they were pretty similar in time frame.
John Bellman, when we saw it, was the draft.
This one is what is on the website.
That's not the report.
And this is the presentation.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. There's a final report, which, as I recall, probably doesn't differ significantly from that. But I reference the final report as the final.
Yeah, I think product. You'll find pages in the final report that are still marked draft.
Oh, are they? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
But it is the final. And that is what everybody was set a copy of.
Okay.
I was going to say, what we got, you can see the binder is
down on the final.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the report laid out a series of different alternatives.
Yeah.
There was a public survey that was sent out, I believe, with the water bills. There were a handful of responses. Off the top of my head, I think it's on the order of maybe 20, 25 responses. So there was some feedback formally.
Yeah.
There was some formal feedback that was received. There was feedback from the public meetings. But there was not really a definitive conclusion as to, you know, here is the one definitive project that we're going to move forward with into the design phase. So I don't want to necessarily go, you know, try and review this whole report, but in general, there were a few different concepts that were proposed, basically revetments along the shoreline, whether that be concrete, mat, or riprap, rock riprap, wetland restoration with some type of breakwater or protective structure. And then beach nourishment. And I think in general, those were kind of the three broad areas that were put out. And there was, from the input, there were some people who were very in favor of, you know, one particular idea. A lot of the input was, you know, broadly, just, I guess I would say, it was not very definitive in, you know, we want this option or we want that option, we don't want that. So part of the idea of moving forward now is that we're trying to move into the final design stage, so we really need to definitively define what it is that the goals and objectives are. And then we'll go away over the next few weeks, work with the ideas that were presented 10 years ago, brainstorm and see if there's other ideas. You know, we certainly want to get you guys' ideas, if there's other, you know, new ideas that have surfaced over the last 10 years. And then work with those. So we're not trying to throw this product out, but we want to make sure that we're, you know, starting from ground zero, basically. Just moving on, Hurricane Ike. I think everybody's quite aware of what happened in Hurricane Ike. You know, the one thing that was very definite that initial discussions with David, the concrete riprap was thrown all over onto the west side of Miramar Drive. I will note that concrete riprap, it's not that much less dense than rock riprap, you know, true good riprap, but there's enough difference in that density that it makes a very large difference in the ability of waves to move it. So I will assure you that a well-designed rock riprap will not be thrown around like concrete. And in general, you know, concrete riprap is not really a good building material. It's very cheap. You see it used a lot. It's typically just thrown out with little or no design applied to it. So I think, in my opinion, we would not be in any way interested in putting out concrete riprap in the future. But I just want to assure people that true, well-designed rock riprap is an entirely different thing than the concrete.
What kind of rock would they use?
Typically in this area, it's limestone, and there's two sources. Most of it comes, it's a bit of a monopoly. It comes from a company called Lure Brothers that are out of Missouri, St. Genevieve, Missouri, and they bring the rock down the Mississippi along the intercoastal, and they bring it on barges. In general, because they can transport, 150 tons on a barge, they have very good low transportation cost. So they typically win the bids on the larger projects. The problem is those barges have to get into shallow water. So either you have to light load the barge or you have to dig an access channel in to get the barge into shore. That sometimes kills the cost savings. And there are some local suppliers that get rock out of the Hill Country area that's also limestone. And you can generally get decent quality limestone out of some of these quarries. They typically bring it by rail right over here to Port Boulevard, just west of the railroad tracks. I don't know if you've ever drive along there, and you'll see they've got a big stockpile of concrete riprap. Occasionally, they'll also have some limestone riprap out there that they bring by rail car and then truck haul it to wherever the job site is.
What about granite?
Granite is very good, but it's very expensive. Typically, the cost. I've never had a project where we've actually successfully used granite, just from a cost perspective. I think typically the cost delta is maybe somewhere on the 50 to 100% higher cost. I know they built Sargent Beach down along Brazoria County or south end of Brazoria County in the Matagorda County. They did all of that with large granite blocks similar to the seawall, the groins along the seawall, and it was very expensive. They basically had to haul one rock on each flatbed and just totally destroy the roads between the quarry and Sargent Beach. Mm. That it's a good product. It's still there. It's very stable, but from a cost perspective, it's just not very competitive. Most of what the Corps of Engineers has done along the dredge disposal islands, etc., has all been limestone in the last 10 to 15 years. Very rarely, I'm trying to think whether they've used granite. I think Sargent Beach was about the last
Texas time. City doesn't have.
Along the
dike,
along the dike, there are granite blocks along there in a lot of stretches.
Is it granite?
Yeah. I think where they've gone in and had repairs, they typically come back with limestone. That'd be mm-hmm. cheaper. Hurricane Ike, not a whole lot more to say about it. I think everybody knows, this history. Moving on to the project history here, the CF grant has been obtained, and that's the funding we're working on now, and I've kind of discussed a little bit about that. In terms of future funding, we don't have anything definitively identified for the construction funding of the project, and that's one of the things that we need to look at and understand is, what kind of financial commitment is the city wanting to make on this project? Are you trying to do this strictly with grant funds? Is there some degree of funding that the city's willing or interested in putting in? because that will affect a little bit the economics of what we're looking for in the project. So all that said, that's a bit of an introduction as to the project as we see it, and you know, certainly if anybody has input, feel free to chime in. But what I wanted to do was to understand from you guys what the goals and objectives of the project were, and I've laid out a handful of agenda items here. We don't necessarily have to follow these in order, but I wanted to give us some structure. So I want to start out by understanding what's the type and level of protection that you're looking for. So in particular, when I say type of protection, what I'm thinking of is, are we talking about, you know, we want something that's going to just protect the Miramar shoreline and keep it stable? And what type of event? Are we talking about day-to-day events? Are we talking about a, you know, 10 to 20-year return interval type storm? Are we talking a 50-year storm, the 100-year storm, et cetera? Because that's really some of the design parameters that we have to understand. And as you can imagine, the higher level of protection you want, the more expensive things become. So there's a bit of a trade-off there in terms of the ability to fund the project in the future.
Well, in the last study, what was used?
We never got into it. It was just very high level. I think we used something like a 10 or 25-year return period to come up with an initial estimate of rock size.
Yeah.
I don't recall if it's actually documented in here, but that's...
Well, if it can all be grant-funded, we want the best.
Well, yeah, whose money are we spending?
If we have to spend money, we're going to spend that last.
As you can imagine, the grants are very competitive.
Yeah.
And you want to show a balance. You want to show that there's something that's going to be sticking around for the grant funding agency. Doesn't think they're going to fund something that's going to be gone in 5 years. On the flip side of that, you know, they also don't want to fund a Cadillac. They probably
right.
want to
no.
cover a Ford.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of good Fords out there.
Yeah.
I don't see us being able to put a 100-year storm project together and get anybody to bid on it.
Yeah.
Get anybody to fund it.